Thank you. So, anyone want to react? I mean, this is really open. It's not just the people at the table. We wanted also to produce, I mean, to show images and clip, not just to talk about things and to use.
Yeah.
Let me tell my story.
Yeah.
Okay. And it fits with the images.
Yes.
Okay. Here's the story, I promised. As we saw in the music video, which I couldn't understand the lyrics to because I'm very hard of hearing, we could see as the video went along the displacement of people from whole ways of life. And at the very end of the video, we saw all those stills of working people. And you could tell by their hairdos that that was some time before the time of the video. One of the things that has happened, not only in the United States, but many other communities where working class people, including poor white people, have lived, has been this process that we call, for want of a better name, gentrification. In the United States today, to give an example of what I mean by mass incarceration as class war, there are about 70 million people who are, because of their record, their criminal record, right, their criminal record, 70 million people who are barred from applying for the kinds of jobs those people in that video had, right, including white people. Now, some people imagine that America First, Make America White Again will solve this problem. But of those 70 million, about a third of them are white people, and the rest are what we call people of color. Welcome to the people of color community. All right. So the argument, one of the prevailing arguments used to justify mass criminalization and mass incarceration, 2.5 million people locked up in the States at this minute, has been gangs. Gang activity, gangsters, gangs. That's the story. Well, that argument, that narrative, that, as it were, kind of official structure of feeling, proliferates into the prison system itself, such that there are prisons within prisons in the United States, modeled actually on Stonheim Prison that used to be here in the former, well, there, here, no. In the former West Germany, there or here, which is a prison within a prison, very, very strong on sensory deprivation, which is where the California Department of Corrections and other prison services put the prisoners who, having already been convicted and sent to prison for some reason, are then charged with certain infractions in the prison and sent to these places where they can only get out if they tell on someone else, get parole, or die. Those are the only ways to get out. Because they're supposedly in gangs, that means that what they are ascribed as being part of is a system of organization, this prison service developed in the late 1970s to undermine prisoner solidarity. So the prisoners are white nationalist prisoners, or white supremacist prisoners, black guerrilla family, and so on and so forth. You get the pattern. All right, these people and their descendants of those who were sent to prison, within the prison under these circumstances, have over time, of course, embraced some of these attributes that were originally assigned to them. And so the prisoners in this prison within a prison, trying to figure out how they could get out of the prison within the prison, used to be divided according to racial, ethnic, and regional origin, and they all equally, who in a prison within a prison, ascribed that racial thinking was the only kind of thinking that could save any community. And they fought desperately to get out while also fighting desperately to maintain white supremacy, black exceptionalism, brown, and so on and so forth. After failing over and over again in this incredibly constrained situation where they can't even see each other, all they can do is shout to each other through the prison walls, they finally realized that the only way for them to get out of the prison within the prison, which was not going to get them out of prison in general, was to send a call out not above to the prison service, but out horizontally to their communities inside and outside, and their call was to end the hostility among the races.
Okay. I would like just to say something about one of the slides, and you may remember I made a presentation in South Africa. The fact that the banana, that fruit, is definitely, I mean, associated in people's mind with blackness in an insulting way. You don't have to say anything. You throw a banana on a soccer field, people, the public will understand it's an insult to a black player. And that, you know, I thought was very interesting. And if you may remember, it's connected to some remarks that were made before. At one point, I mean, there was during a game some 4 or 5 years ago, the black player, it was in Italy, he picked up the banana, peeled it, and started to eat it and throw it. And it, you know, it was film and it went viral. And so his friend, he was Brazilian, the Brazilian player started to say, has a hashtag, we are all monkeys, you know. And so everyone was taking a picture of a selfie, eating a banana, we are all monkeys. And black women of Brazil protested, say, we are not monkey. Monkey is an insult. So so I thought it was interesting that, you know, also the kind of like non-racism and not anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And the fact also, and also the connection between banana as really a sign. There is no need to have a comment on that. You throw a banana, you present a banana to Christian Taubira, who was the Minister of Justice in France. Everyone will understand it's an insult. You don't have to say a thing. And I think that's also interesting too, in terms of like not even speaking, not even, you know, saying anything. You just throw a banana. Mm-hmm.
Demetrios, so.
Sharon, you wanted to say something?
Okay, the banana thing is a good example, maybe also it's equivalent to the Bannon question about what does it mean that people say openly racist things, that people openly present those symbols that are seen as such. And I was wondering if you think that also, the banana is a manifestation of such a change of paradigm. And what about all those things that we've been dealing with in the last 30 years, 50 years, whatever, all the time frame in which we were thinking of racism as something that couldn't be expressed openly, where we were talking about cultural racism or culturalism, where people would have to talk indirectly and the symbols that are related to that. What about, do you think that all of this disappeared suddenly, or what's the analysis behind, you know, focusing on those events, the Bannon event, the banana issue? I mean, what's the relationship between those two types of racism? Is it like a change of paradigms? Does it mean anti-racism has lost a long struggle? How do we explain them if we think they're important? So I wanted to ask, you know, the question of the relationships of power, the ways in which we explain that by social forces, by, you know, the amount and capacity and intensity of struggles that lie behind those events. And we need to have an explanation that's a political explanation, that's an explanation that draws on, you know, fields of struggle and fields of power.
I think this is a very important question. It's linked to the re-embrace explicitly of freedom of expression, but only certain kinds of expression, right? You can say whatever you want, so long as it's not critical of the forms of power that underpin the social formation or social condition. Mm-hmm. So you see a proliferation of all kinds of racist expression, right? But as soon as you criticize Israel, as soon as you criticize the state, as soon as you step out of line in various sorts of ways, as soon as you try to speak in certain institutions, not least some universities in various parts of the world, in particular sorts of ways, you know, not least of which is also invoking a form of criticality in relation to racism in those institutions. It's like, what are you talking about? That's not us, right? It's kind of, or you can't say these things at all. I mean, there's a ban on in some institutions and in some forms, to tell another quick story, there's a ban on criticizing Israel explicitly. So in Arizona, the legislature, the state legislature, passed legislation that state funding couldn't be used to fund speakers from within or outside the universities in that state who are critical of Israel. So you're presented with a form as a speaker to get reimbursed or to get an honorarium, and on that form you have to sign that you're not going to criticize Israel, and if you do criticize Israel, you will be denied the funding or the reimbursement that you get. And the way around it has been to fund speakers by private funding, not by state funding, right? So you see the way in which institutional forms of expression are at once licensed on one hand and de-licensed on the other, depending on what they are. And it's linked to forms of power.
I was just making a connection.
You have something to say?
Say something about the first picture. About, it was an asylum seeker committed suicide or something?
No, it was a young black man of 19 years old in Columbus, Ohio, a university town, who had a knife, was threatening to commit suicide. And the image was not as clear on the screen as the police officer who was called to confront the man and try to talk him out of what he was doing had a drawn gun in his hand behind his back, right? Yeah. And it's a metaphor for larger forms of racial power.
This is happened in Sweden when Afghan asylum seeker committed suicide, and he was arrested after that. It was an attempt to, and now he's sentenced to prison. So this goes back to this invisibility Hannah Arendt about, natural visibility and political invisibility but also that we don't, how we see them, the gaze you talked about. And this life cannot be lost. We cannot lose this life because this life has been seen as a life from beginning, as Butler has written about. So this is, it's about asylum seekers too, exactly the same.
There's a question. Yeah. Is the microphone somewhere? No? Could you stand up and speak then? Yeah. Where are you?
Nobody's in there.
Can you hear me? Yes. Okay. I'm not really sure if I'm far away from where you are now, but I just wondering what is the solution to get out of this, what I can call racism embrace, especially for me now as a person here, sitting here. And
response in the third session.
To get personally in the position of a mother, to have to raise a new generation, and dealing with the question how we explain and how we build new solidary lives and create new symbols and create new words for a free world, maybe. How do we do that?
That's a question that we have to discuss collectively. Not one person can answer that, but it's I hope that this is going to become a larger discussion through this 3 days of the question of solidarity and radical dependency, as Ruti has called it. I think it's absolutely, it's a question for each of us every day, I would say. I don't know each of us, but a lot of us. A lot of us. Okay, we're going to move to the second round, again, of a picture and ask you to react.
and audible gasp.
Thank you. Again, remark.
I was thinking about the body floating, you know, and questions about how we can show and talk about something at the same time, have respect, you know, that, you know, the question of visualizing, how we visualize a crisis.
Can we remove the image? It's not something...
That's very important. I mean, we see, you know, bodies packed in boats or dead bodies. I mean, the famous one, Alan Kurdi, 3 years old Syrian. And it's a very important question, and I'm still struggling how we can show a problem at the same time not defacing them, not denaming them, at the same time bring up the issue. Yeah, that's a very important question. So I see this defacing, denaming very common in the images.
Just to answer to you, I think the picture, the first picture you show of the Brooks, the famous slave ship, you know, the Brooks, was a way of representing what was happening in the slave ship without, in fact, representing. And it's one of the most powerful images of until today. And it was a very important... they went to the port, I mean, the abolitionists, again and again and again to really get all the information before doing that. And in a way, it's I would say that picture is still as powerful as it was. Mm. And you don't need to have the body. You just see it. I mean, sorry, Cher.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something, because you mentioned the image of Alan Kurdi. And I think there's a really fundamental difference between the image of Alan Kurdi and all the other images of dead bodies of refugees and migrants that we have seen in the past, and including this one. As you know, you have said you don't want to look at that picture because it's disturbing, and most people don't want to see those pictures with dead bodies that, you know, represent suffering and pain, and that's something where people don't want to look at. I mean, charity organizations don't know that for a long time now. Right, and I think the difference with Alan Kurdi was, I looked into this a little bit back at the time. When you look at the statements and accounts of people who were confronted with that picture, one of the things that people were saying similarly across Europe was when they were saying it, they looked at the child and they said, "It looks like a sleeping child, and it looks like my son when he's sleeping." Mm. So, and that allowed people to look at the image, allowed them to, you know, let it in, and with letting that image of a sleeping boy, you know, enter your consciousness, enter your mind, you would also then let in all the facts and all the realities of immigration and the pain and the death and the misery. And this is why it had such a big impact. It was shared much, I mean... 20 times more than any other image in relation to the refugee crisis. And there's people who did a research on Twitter, on Twitter data, who argue that this was one of the fundamental things that happened for the shift of public opinion in the UK concerning the refugee crisis. So what I'm saying, and to the things that you where we say we have to take care, I mean, we have to think about, reflect how we represent suffering.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that we might have in mind when we do that.
Okay, okay.
But I mean, okay, it's interesting,
okay.
You know.
1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, but there is someone from the public.
But this is very well related to this.
Yeah, but it's also to give.
Thank you.
To the audience.
I wanted to ask if you could give me or us a little bit more information about one of the slides you have shown about the where you can see a couple of white people whom I would read as white people saying I'm proud to be racist, because just remark aside, actually I'm thankful for people, for white people who say I'm proud to be a racist, because if people say I'm anti-racist, then I get it gets suspective, right? So actually it's a good thing for people, white people, to say I'm proud to be a racist. That's my opinion as a person of color and an Asian German living in Germany. So maybe a little bit more information about the background of this slide where the white people are saying I'm proud to be a racist.
You wanted to react right away.
Yeah,
and
I
then
think
after.
One question is about why Alan Kurdi, I mean, imagining refugees suffering body, but also innocent body.
Exactly.
Sleeping.
Yeah, sleeping, 3 yeah. years old.
Not
yeah,
dead.
It's exact. But the question is, same week, 3 black kids, body of them were discovered in the Mediterranean Sea. Why we don't think about that? I mean, talking about that. The question is, yes, Twittering goes up and people are talking about Alan Kurdi, but borders are still there, you know, the deportation is still there. And the third comment is, how about the father of Alan Kurdi? How about, I mean, we can talk about, we want to talk about Alan Kurdi, we want to show his body because it's good to, you know, mobilize anti-racist love. But how about his, cousin? Do we ask them too? I mean, did we ask this mother of this young man's body if we can show the picture here today or publish it or not? How about them? This is racism. Mm-hmm. We don't count them in. Mm-hmm. We talk about them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing has been also to collect the name of the people and make that was different.
Sure.
Okay. Could we just sure. the audience first, yeah. and then Maya and Ruti, mm-hmm. and then we will move to the next round.
I would like to add to that. I mean, there was another study done on this, on the circulation of the image, that I thought was a highly dubious study, that was looking at supposedly studying compassion in relation to circulation of the image by looking at, indeed at, I think, Google searches and the amount of donations. That was a fairly large study. And I think looking at the image of Alan Kurdi and the response to that falls into what has been raised earlier, is the concept of humanitarianism as how that is connected to securitization. And I think victimization is also plays a very crucial role in that. Because that study did not look into political consequences. It looked into donations, which is an expression, it's not all wrong, but of course it's an expression of, in the continuum of humanitarianism and victimization, and not necessarily of political enabling, right? And the other thing is that, of course, but what that study revealed, or what they sort of claimed was one of their findings, was that there is a limit, like even if it's more than one person, compassion is reduced. People can only feel compassion to a singular person. If there's two, maybe, but anything above that, then that's too many. Which, anyway, I'm still puzzled by that, but I've been also working on the circulation of such images, and especially that. And I just wanted to add, you have to remember that it's also the politics of the image of the child plays a very crucial role. So at the time, let's say David Cameron was launching his Save Our Children campaign, that was also when it was all about closing the borders. And I'm only reminding of, for instance, Jose Munoz, who was criticizing in queer theory, criticizing Lee Edelman's concept of no future by saying there's what he was calling to crisis of Afrofuturism. At that time, he meant the life and the future of young black children in the U.S. And so here, it's a highly complex thing, but I think it is also the status of the image is not one that is easily defined by, let's say, by how it was made or what we see, but also the way they're circulated and how they're referred to.
But I, if I may say also, it's who are the children who are fabricated as innocent and those who are fabricated exactly. as criminal, like Palestinian children who are criminalized by the state of Israel, and then you can see their body and it will not, you know, produce empathy. So there is not, innocence is not equally distributed, innocence of childhood.
That's right.
Maya and Ruti, and then we move to the next round.
So just on the point of the same image and to make the connection with empathy, as Nana said the word compassion, eventually these things are about kind of the emotional crescendo or the sort of porn-esque experience of the viewer. And one thing you see in the humanitarian space now is this interest in technologies of virtual reality. And a lot of UN-sponsored and other kind of VR films to generate empathy for various people. To kind of support and encourage things like donations. But again, it's about this very masturbatory effect of the viewer itself. So you experience things. But I will recommend that people look for a film that came out recently. I think the name of the NGO is, I think it's Refugee Child or Refugee International. I'll get the name. It's one of the best films that I've seen recently because it's a very short clip. It shows a refugee camp situation. There's a young boy and his father walking together, and the father is telling the kid a story. Father's very kind of exhausted and whatever, but then the child suddenly is being told a story about the superhero. The superhero comes and takes the child and shows him the camp from their flying, and it's all very exciting. And then the superhero is, of course, you know, has, it looks a bit like Batman, brings the child back. And then they very slickly show that actually the superhero is the father. And the video is really that it's about the father of the child who is the refugee, who is actually the superhero, who has to deal with the fact that his child is a refugee, is in a camp, and has to create stories or find ways to take this child out of the situation that he's in. And I mean, and I think that that was one of the few films that tried to shift this victim narrative and talk about what is actually kind of the reality of being a refugee and living in a camp. So just wanted to throw that in there.
Ruti, you wanted to add something?
Sure, I recommend that people check out the work of a collective called Abu Nadara. They're Syrian filmmakers, artists who make maybe 60 to 90 second video that they've been publishing on their website maybe once a week. And what they're doing is trying to sort of claim, not reclaim, claim the dignity of the image in order to avoid the, you know, these are the innocent, worthy victims and so on and so forth. And their work is totally fabulous, as is their politics.
Okay, we're gonna move to the last round of
Clear the issue of like white people being racist.
Yeah, the, that image was from it's an Israeli woman in Israel declaring herself and those with her in the context of the, you know, kill Arabs being painted on walls and doors and so on in East Jerusalem.
Sorry,
Francois.
Thank you. So you had the Kerry James rap was, you got the translation. I mean, there was a translation if you want to look at the.
Study session.
Perfectly. Feels like a seminar.
So any reaction?
Homework.
Any comments? Can go back also to preceding, you know, comments. I mean, not something.
There was a picture of the Schwarze Piet
And also before there was a picture with Angela Merkel and the black-faced person next to her, probably representing Melchior of the Three Kings. And what we didn't discuss yet was like the deep connection between Christianity and racism emerging in, like as a imperialistic faith in the connection with modernity. And there's a German theologian, Eske Wollrath. She's questioning like how to handle racism as a system of faith, because racism also, you need to believe in something which is not existing. So my question would be to the table also, like, would it be possible to imagine an anti-racist faith, or would that be a strategy of establish a anti-racist or like a discourse outside of the racist discourse?
Thank you. Any? So we're going to take. Okay. Oh, in the back over there. On the left.
I have a, maybe I'll shortly try to summarize what I'm coming from to the question, but you mentioned before Arizona and a certain ban on talking about, like, criticizing Israel. And before that, we talked about Germany and the problem with race as a concept, as I understood, if I understood correctly, that's being introduced to some sort of debate only recently. And where I come from Poland, like, this debate around Holocaust and around anti-Semitism was brought into a public discussion just a few years ago. That was a very, like, violent discussion also. And just a few weeks ago, the Polish president signed the legislation that prevents the testimonies that would, like, implicate Polish participation in extermination of Jews. And I talk about this because I'm thinking, like, when we talked about, or you talked about anti-racism, whether in places like Poland, where it's all, like, in general in Europe, where, like, this racism, as you said, is not only inscribed in capitalism, but in whole politics of identity, and, like, the state seem to be the power that is reinforcing the racist narratives on and on. So there is, like, a problem with forming, like, a certain consciousness or political consciousness that would overcome those very old identities. So my question to you would be, to quote Zygmunt Bauman, because he talked about cosmopolitan consciousness. And I'm wondering whether you would say that this could be an answer to this, like, problem with what's anti-racism, how can we overcome at all this dynamic of, like, talking about race, and where would you see the fields of this consciousness to emerge, because it's certainly not the state. And I could say that in Poland, majority of society doesn't have access to academic discourse on identities. So I wonder, where is this possible stream and transformation of consciousness, and where we could search that?
Thank you. The last. Okay.
Just let it run and then people can respond.
That's it. Yeah. Go ahead.
We could. Yeah.
Yes. Would I want to put in the discussion is something that was said in the song by Kerry James, that racism cannot be put apart from colonialism, and colonialism is mainly about exploitation. So it is a discourse of racism and anti-racism, and it's okay to be aware of the racism thing. But I think that we cannot separate it from colonialism, and we would have, or I think it would be useful to actualize the colonialization thing item, because what are we living in? What kind of world we are living in? Are we really, as he says, having a republic, or what is it, this form of government, and what kind of exploitation it does guarantee? I mean, those items, I think, that shouldn't be left apart in the discussion all the time.
More? Over there, in the back.
Okay, thank you. First of all, my English is not so good, so I apologize. I have a question, especially for Serhat Karakayali, but also for the other members of the board. So, like, at least for the German context, racism is not only tied to colonialism, but also functions very much along the lines of migration. So, especially in 2015 and 16, Me Too, I was very surprised by the huge amount of solidarity coming from the like German public along across the so-called color line, maybe. But you earlier mentioned this image of the family. I also associate the family with like clear hierarchies and maybe patriarchy or something like that. And this was also something I could really see in this movement of solidarity, paternalism. Especially, how can we get rid of paternalism within solidarity? First question, and then secondly, I do see this solidarity from 2015 and 16 as sort of cracks within the racist capitalist system. How can we connect those different cracks in the system and smash it in the German context?
I would be sitting here if I knew.
Okay, there was a question in the back, please. Okay. I mean, in the back, I'm sorry to say that. In my own.
Okay, so, okay.
We hear you.
I actually want to thank my last commenter because I want to take off right there. I think that in the German context, as far as I can know, second wave feminism had to articulate itself through class, because that was the only Marxist language that men could understand, right? Domination, exploitation, capitalism, and so on. And actually, I want to ask why, I don't know this, but why there is, or why at least I don't see many discussions connecting race to gender. And I know that academics call a particular phenomenon the dogma line, where certain things can only be articulated in the private, right? And that's where supposedly there is a fear, there is a sphere where production happens and where exploitation happens, where surplus is, and then there is one where reproduction happens, and that is the domestic one. And I wonder why that sort of, that's not very, why that dimension is not in our discussion very often. I hope my question was clear.
Okay. Answers, response? I mean, you were put on the spot, so I suppose you want to answer.
Yeah, I have
right?
to.
Okay.
I don't have the answer to the last question. But we are, I mean, I guess I'm looking for it. And this is why I thought it would be useful, I mean, not to ignore the things that you've just mentioned. I mean, that's part of, probably I'm just emphasizing the other side, because what I see around myself and all my colleagues, what all my colleagues are doing, they're just seeing that. They're just writing about paternalism, racism. I mean, I went into a workshop this year where about so-called welcome culture, and almost all the presentations were about how racist, how colonialist, how whatever, paternalist, the welcome practices and initiatives actually were. And I found that's not very useful because at a certain level of abstraction, and you will find racism and paternalism everywhere, and it wouldn't make sense to, politically, to compare, you know, that kind of initiatives and political activism with right-wing people who actually want to kill refugees. So if you want to understand political activism, I think you have to confront yourself with contradictions and incoherences all the time. I mean, and being successful at the end, like what you've said, so what, there are still borders. I mean, that can't be a criterion for political actions altogether, because if I mean, particularly for left-wing radical activism, then we've all failed the last 200 years. So if the criterion is for you know, refugee solidarity movements, for anti-racist movements to abolish racism and abolish borders and abolish the nation, then all anti-racism was futile. I mean, I don't think that makes sense. And I wanted to say something else about this idea of, you know, the idea that all the racism remains kind of the same everywhere, all throughout time, throughout history. And I sense that, and I hear that in the debate. You know, one contribution from the audience when was it's the same, or it's even better when someone says that he's openly racist, as if he's not. Mm. That basically means, well, those people who, you know, have a different, you know, employ a different mode of racism, if you wish, actually, you know, behind that and deep down, they're actually, you know, Nazis or whatever. I don't think that's the way we should understand racism today. I think, if I can refer to something that you've said, race is a product of practices. Race is a product of, you know, politics. It's something that is created through institutions, through organizations, through struggles. If we say that, that means something also for different spaces. And the banana example, I mean, to just make this comparison, criticizing Israel and is the banana in Germany. And in the German context, you know, when the first thing that comes to your mind when it comes to oppression and to racism and everything is Israel, people will be suspecting you of being actually wanting to say something else.
Hang on,
I'm not saying you're doing that, but I'm saying it has the same, response, you know, racism is something that, and those very symbols need a frame, need a, you know, frame of meaning, of signs, and signifiers, and in Germany that's a different framework. I'm just, you know, just to make sense of all of the of the idea that racism is not the same everywhere.
Racism absolutely is not the same everywhere. As somebody who has received death threats for the criticism of Israel in the US and in the UK, right? Literally,
this is not about.
There are two things to be said in response to criticizing Israeli racism. First, racism in most every period in which it occurs is identified, there's an identifier of an elsewhere which allows one not to be racist here. Right, so racism is over there, it's in South Africa under apartheid, it's in Israel now, and so on, which gets us off the hook because we don't practice that form of expression. But that speaks to the differential conditions of racism in different sites. Exactly. The other thing goes back to the opening discussion where I said that racism anywhere is shored up by racism elsewhere, right? And you know, the fact that Israel is easily criticizable, although not, right? I mean, you can get threatened with death for doing that or be called a terrorist and so on publicly and so on, speaks to the fact that that when one actually tries to open up the possibility of a critical discussion around those questions, it's to put it in relation to forms of racism and political power that are in circulation in a variety of spaces, not least the US, but in South Africa, for example, you get a similar kind of, even today, kind of resistance in certain populations to opening up that question. In France, you get a resistance to that question, and so on. So I think it's a much more complicated sort of interactive engagement that one needs to
Ruth, you wanted to say something?
I do. And Maya. I do. I want to say something about consciousness in response to our colleague from Poland who spoke very eloquently. And that is, I'm very saddened by the thought that consciousness is something that's produced by academics and then dispersed to other people. That's not the case. Quite the inverse, as the story that I told about the people in that prison in California, I hoped would demonstrate. While they studied a lot, they're not academics. They were prisoners, mostly doing life which means most of them were convicted of killing somebody. All right? They, rich people kill people too. They were poor, they did this. They were white, brown, black, red, yellow. Their consciousness changed because they began to understand differently because of the literal constraints in which they were operating, what their experience meant. Which is to say, they didn't go straight in a frictionless way from experience to understanding to action. There's no such thing. But consciousness is not a product of academics. It's not. Some of us who have day jobs as academics like to lift it up because we think it's important. It is important. But all we're doing really, and here I'm echoing my dear friend Paul Gilroy, is we're kind of ventriloquizing what we learned in the streets. We're not inventing anything. Okay? So, consciousness. Don't think you have to go to school for it, but you do have to pay attention.
I would like just to say something about the question of gender and colonialism. I mean, gender, I mean, I talk about the fact that effectively, and David also talked, and many, the fact that sexism and racism are absolutely interconnected in capitalism. And capitalism needs inequality, and it's not just racial inequality, it's going to be gender inequality. And I mean, I suppose we have still 3 days, and we may discuss also what I suggested, that women's rights are also a new form of vocabulary, racial vocabulary today in Western Europe. So it's a discussion that we need to have. We're not going to cover everything, but you are right. This is a discussion we need to have. On the question of colonialism also, of course, Kerry Jem is talking about that, and we do know that in France particularly there is a total repression of the colonial past but worse, of the history of slavery. Mm-hmm. I mean, slavery, it's acknowledged, but the role that slavery played in the making of France and its culture and philosophy is absolutely not acknowledged. So it's still effectively a struggle we have to go on. And the way the colonial past the way in which racism find ways borrowing from the colonial past. But I do think also that we have to look at things that are not necessarily connected with the colonial past today, not directly, even in France, not directly. And so, as many of us say, and even you say, that we have to look at this, you know, constant different level that are not necessarily interconnected, in fact, but they are there, all together, at the same moment, and that we have to look at that. Mm-hmm. But Maya, wanted to say something.
Actually, which sort of connects to what you just said, Françoise, and the question about Christianity and colonialism really kind of spoke to me, because I grew up in a sort of Christian mission ghetto. It was a place that was set up by Christian missionaries from the U.S. 200 years ago to train Indian women to be doctors, because there weren't doctors in the late 1800s who were women. So my parents sort of... and this is a very well-known medical school in India now. It's one of the top three. It's great. But it's supported and funded by the World Council of Churches. And it very much has this mentality of, well, Christianity as a civilizing force, very much part of the colonial sort of makeup of that part of South India. And so I grew up with a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus and really wanted, it took a long time for me to kind of understand, even though I was studying geography and studying, you know, kind of Bible history and all of that, history and geography, that, wait, you don't have blonde, blue-eyed people in what is now, you know, the Levant or that part of the Mediterranean coastline. You don't have that. So, of course, that kind of learning and undoing happens later. But fast forward to now, we're actually... Christians are, like Muslims in India, are a highly persecuted minority slash majority in what is being portrayed as this Hindu nation. India is being recast as this Hindu nation now, and there's a very problematic kind of fascist thing going on. So you have Christians, missionaries, practitioners who are all working class and poor people and of lower caste actually being killed for being Christian. There's active movements against inter-caste and inter-religious movements. Mm-hmm. So there's Hindu thugs that go and break up couples, and this is a whole other story. But the point of all of this is that it hasn't ended. That colonialism, the British left, and I like to kind of have provocative conversations at home about how we continue to reproduce those colonialisms in different ways. So we're doing it now with caste, we're doing it now as, you know, Hindus and saying that, you know, we have a certain kind of Hindu identity, we're doing it to Muslims, we're doing it to Christians. It's like roaches, you know, it's like cockroaches. It just kind of doesn't go away sometimes. And I think that we have to be aware that it's not cats.
Really? Cats?
You mean cats can kill cockroaches? I don't think so. The roaches have been around a lot longer.
That's a theory. On this uplifting note, I think we have to.
Cats and cockroaches, good.
Okay, I think, you know, it's time because there is at 7:30, I want to remind all of us that there is a talk today. It's today, right?
Mm.
Yeah. At 7. Suddenly, you know, I'm like,
it was yesterday, François. You missed it. Then.
A round table with Etienne Balibar, Veronica Cago, Kaushik Sundararayan, and Manuela Bojavec. So at 7:30 in the tutorial. And so we're going to really close. You want to say something?
Well, first, thank you to these incredible panelists for bringing us together. They provided comprehension for the incomprehension of racism that Manuela started with. So thank you very much. We'll see you back here at 7:30.
Yeah.
You've been a fabulous audience. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.